that I've kind of ever come across, in the sense that, you know, every year you keep going at the well, just punching out these cool businesses. So it's going to be fascinating to understand, like, have you developed a formula for doing it, you know? Anyway, we'll dig into that. Welcome everybody to Founders Focus. It's episode 16. We're doing this wonderful series. I don't know whether you're enjoying this as much as I am, but I'm really enjoying speaking with and learning from individuals that have gone ahead and set up these radical technology businesses that are changing the way which we work today. I think it's like really interesting to get into the minds of the people that think there's something different out there, and you know what, they're going to go and try and do it. So today I'm delighted to welcome, I think, one of the most interesting dudes we've had on Founders Focus so far, Jonathan Romley of Lundy. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Hung, it's good to be here.
I need to ask you as well. Firstly, great to welcome you on the show. We're going to dig deep into, you know, your history and what's driven you and all of this. But firstly, what busy things did you have to cancel in order to turn up to Founders Focus today? Was there what kind of CEOing stuff that you have to like push to the bottom of the calendar in order to come onto this show?
Well, to be fair, we planned far in advance, and I'm planning my calendar with enough time in order to make time for you, for sure.
You liar, Jonathan. You absolute liar. And you should be lying. You should be making space for a live stream or a podcast, even something that Brain Food does. But I do appreciate your politeness in saying so. So Jonathan, very quickly, do you want to quickly intro what Lundy is? Because it's an interesting concept, but it's a concept we've kind of seen maybe before, but it's coming around again, and maybe even more hyper-relevant in this remote first, you know, internationalized type of era. So give us a quick strapline as to what Lundy is.
Well, knowing your audience, Hung, I mean, from an inside baseball perspective, Lundy's a recruitment marketplace. So what that means is, you know, there are recruitment marketplaces in the US, in the UK, and those are platforms that connect employers that are looking to fill contingent search requisitions with recruiters that will fill those requisitions, right? That will source, screen, and submit candidates for those roles. What we're doing differently at Lundy is that we've taken that concept that's, you know, in the US and in the UK, and we've said, well, what if we did it globally? You know, what if we went to as many countries as we could, most importantly, those where talent is available, or maybe more so when we think about recruiters, like recruiters just not available at all, actually. More job postings for recruiters than software engineers last year, right? But in any case, what we've done is kind of globalized that. So if you're an employer that's in the US or you're an employer that's in the UK and you're thinking about hiring internationally, so Lundy's a great solution for you. We're doing two things really well. The first one is global talent mapping. So, you know, when you've got a job that you need to fill and you can fill that job remotely, we like to say that anywhere isn't a country, and remote is like not a city. And I think that the biggest challenge for companies that are open to hiring remotely is actually thinking about where to start, because you don't want to spend much effort searching for talent where it maybe doesn't exist. So the first thing that we're doing is identifying for a role where you can actually source for that role. And then we're connecting your requisition with recruiters that are in the market, that are on the ground. We like to call them local talent experts that can help close your hire. They're gonna source locally in the language and even come back with some feedback, like maybe this isn't gonna work in Romania, the same thing that works in Poland. And in this way, you can very rapidly access talents in markets really around the world with, you know, vetted talent experts that we've interviewed, screened, talked to, and have already had success on our platform. So that's what we do at Lundy. We're, you know, like the new platform for global talent acquisition.
You know, I'm really attracted to a couple of things you said there, Jonathan, particularly this idea of, you know, a lot of people don't know where to start. I mean, we're hearing about, hey, it's a global talent marketplace. But how many of us are actually thinking hard about where the talent is and then positioning some, you know, targeting some resources to, in order to hire those places? I see what most companies are doing is simply putting out a job saying remote everywhere, and then they're just like absorbing whatever comes in from wherever without too much like strategy as to where they want those resources from. So I guess with your solution is, okay, you're going to tell me where it is best to hire a data scientist. And then we're going to deliver against that by connecting the job vacancy with local suppliers that can supply against it. So I think that is a pretty clear workflow. And I think it'd be interesting to see what the marketplace treats it. Let's hop back because I've been trying to check back your career, your personal career, Jonathan. And like, as I mentioned at the start of the show, like you're a serial entrepreneur. Why is it that you're always the boss of every business? Have you kind of thought about this? Why are you always in charge?
To be fair, everyone always has a boss. I have a board, so I do still have people that I report to. There are very few businesses or very few jobs, I think, that anyone can have, right? Even if you're a consultant, your client is the boss. If you're a CEO, the board is the boss, or your investors, okay, maybe not the boss, but anyway, they're there. And I've not always been the boss, just to be fair. But I think I'm really fascinated with solving problems, with looking at a problem, trying to come up with a solution for it. Maybe also ones that have kind of a global reach or scale or cross-border element to it. I've spent a lot of time outside of my home country. And I'm from the US, I'm from California, from Southern California, from Los Angeles, but eventually moved up and was living in the Bay Area. But I haven't lived in the US really in the last 10 years. And I've spent so much of that time traveling. In some ways as a digital nomad, but you know, also just in one place for a while, working to solve a problem and to build a company in markets like Poland, in Ukraine, and even in South China. So I'm having fun. I'm really having fun.
I think we can see that. And, you know, there's a couple of interesting things to touch on there. From all of the companies that you've led and the businesses that you worked in, have you got any sort of formula or any kind of things that you think, you know what, this tends to work most of the time? And if I was to do another startup again, I'm probably going to lean into this activity or lean into this area because it is definitely something that works. Can you give us some of that sort of insight, Jonathan?
Sure. So I'm right now in Turkey in a hotel where I gave a talk 7 years ago. Oh, wow. I think about 7 years ago on exactly this subject. It was a startup Turkey in Antalya. I'm in kind of the Mediterranean coast of Turkey now. And I'll give you the same answer that I've said in the same place 7 years ago. It's pick a universal problem. Particularly if you're outside of the like first world market, right? So if you're not in New York, San Francisco, LA, Paris, London, whatever, pick a problem that is something that everyone will understand. Universal problem. So like the difficulty of acquiring talent, that's a pretty universal problem, right? We can go all over the world. Everybody has a problem hiring right now. And okay, it's a lot more pronounced, this issue, than it was a couple of years ago. But this was, you know, this is a real thing that's been happening forever. Companies always need to grow. And I think that the challenge globally, the risk, is that today's most promising companies will never become the global powerhouses that they could, you know, because they just can't hire fast enough. So pick a problem that is universal. One, that it doesn't matter where you are in the world, that people understand this problem and that you can understand this problem. An example, I was on the board of an accelerator, a startup investment fund years ago. And I was in Ukraine, and a company that really had, they had a really wonderful looking product. Really, it was a great looking product. But they had this idea, they were going to solve the challenges of procurement in the US. And I asked if they'd ever been in the US and they said no. So, you know, like this, maybe we try to avoid doing that. Probably don't do that. But nice product. It was a nice product, but without any context, right? So you want to go after problems that you understand. And I think that's the other thing, like universal problems that I understand. So if you look at my career as an entrepreneur, I've just gone after universal problems that I understand.
You know what? I think that's a really good strap line to keep a hold of. Not only a universal problem that you understand, but also a problem that maybe you can explain. So I think a standard of whether you can, a standard of your understanding, if you like, is your ability to articulate it. Can you explain the problem to somebody else? That kind of gives us an, basically, if you can do that, it means that you do actually grok this issue. And therefore, you know, this is solid ground for you to operate in. And as you say, sometimes being, you know, traveling around and seeing these local scenarios, I've done a little bit of travel, nowhere near as much as you. But I think the thing that I've gotten from that is that you do see with fresh eyes, simply by going to a new place that, hey, listen, that could be a, something you could solve. Or so that is something that's a solution waiting to emerge in this context. If you're staying in one place all the time, I think that you have sometimes this, you inevitably become a little bit too used to every sight and sound and you know, all the words and everything becomes very similar to you. And it becomes actually more difficult to spot problems, I think. You know, the idea of actually interacting with different cultures, I think, is critically important in this way. Spooling back again, keeping with the history of it, Jonathan, what are the sort of CEO things that you think that you are not very good at? So if we could look at, you've done this, you've been, this is not your first rodeo, you've been running companies before, you've done, you know, been successful in a number of different businesses. You must be aware by now, like what kind of like activities involved in being a CEO where you can say, you know what, that's probably not my strong suit. That's where I need maybe to get someone in. I need to get rid of this as a task. Can you tell us a little bit about those things?
So I think that recruiting as a CEO is something that you always have to do. Don't worry. That's the one thing I'm not going to say that I'm bad at and need help with. But what I will say is that you really have to surround yourself with people that do everything better than you. So being an entrepreneur, being a startup CEO, this career, if we want to call it that, you know, breeds kind of generalism. Like you're good at you're just okay at a lot of different things. So it's pretty easy to find people that are better than you at just about everything. And I think that the challenge for leaders, right, is one, to admit that it's okay. Probably everybody else that's specialized can do whatever it is that I'm doing right now better than me. And bringing those people onto the team as quickly as possible, but then being able to let go of that responsibility and know maybe it won't be done exactly the way that you were going to do it, but it will be done probably by somebody. And if you've done your recruitment right, if you've built your management team correctly, by somebody that's more experienced, that's been, you know, ducked down, head down on this for their entire career or the last 5 or 10 years. And I think that that's a challenge for everyone. It's a challenge for everyone in a leadership role to give away more and more and more of your responsibility. But if you don't do it, you'll never grow.
You've actually introduced a really good idea here, Jonathan, which is the idea that sometimes being a specialist, because sometimes when you become a CEO, you can get there through being a specialist, right? I only a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to, was it Tony Jamus, maybe? I think it was him. And he was like a product guy. So he basically worked in product or whatever, very specialist in this space. And he became that person as a CEO. But he had to let that go. Whereas being a generalist might actually be to your advantage, because maybe letting go is easier, right? You're not coming in with this idea you're an expert at all of these things. You kind of are aware that you're just okay, using your terms, and you're looking for someone who's better than you. You know, it's like a different mindset.
I mean, to be fair, from a background perspective, I'm an engineer, so I think that you know where I probably have the biggest challenges in that area are around things related to engineering. But at the same time, yeah, I've learned to let that go, right? It's not going to be the way that you planned. But the good news about code is that like no one really sees it if it does what it's supposed to. So if it does what it's supposed to, it doesn't matter how somebody did it.
Yeah. And again, that idea of sort of whenever you've delegated it, it's going to be it's not going to be what you imagine. That's the thing that I think gets most people. Because if you go in there and try and like correct people's effort or output based on what you've imagined you would do, you're going to spend all of your time redoing what everyone else has already done for you. You've got to basically just accept, look, is this going to get it through the door? Is this going to get it over the line, so to speak? And that will do. Get it shipped, get it done, and then move on to the next thing. Because as a CEO, there's going to be an endless list of things that you need to do. There's no one component that is necessarily always going to be more important than the rest. It's almost like getting lots of the thing going and making sure that machine keeps flying on. What are the things, the opposite question of this, Jonathan, what are the things that you say that you are good at, like as a CEO? If you could break down sort of the things of a CEO, like what are the things that you think, you know what, I bring this to the table if I was in charge of a business?
I think one of the most important roles at almost any stage is a function of talent acquisition. Now, you may have somebody in charge of TA, global TA leader, a TA leader in your organization, but in the beginning, you're not going to have that. And your role as a leader is to rally people around your idea. You know what? You might not really have any money. You might have raised a couple of bucks, maybe not. You don't have some great benefits program to offer. You don't have shit in the beginning, right?
Yeah, you don't have a brand. You don't have anything.
Nothing. You got nothing. And somehow you've got to convince people that they should get on that rocket ship ride. And I think that's something that's really important. I mean, I won't say that I think that I do it well, but I've done it repeatedly. And I'm really happy with the people that are on my team, and I'm really happy with the people that have been on the teams in the companies that I've founded or been an executive at, and it's played such a big role in company building for me. How we build the team, who is on the team, and you know, how we're going to convince people in the stage that we're at as a business, sometimes without a lot to offer, how we're going to bring in the best people we can that are going to set us up for success.
I think that's actually one of this is the biggest stumbling block for most startups. The inability to basically bring people with you at the very early stages. I know a few founders, a few friends of mine actually that have set up businesses that obviously require like a co-founding team. They obviously require people around them to make this happen. But they've been unable to convert those folks for whatever reason. And maybe they haven't had the fortune to know them in advance. I think sometimes that helps, right? If you've got some sort of
like, Rolodex helps.
Yeah. If you habitually keep people like in contact, like sometimes maybe this is where my recruitment sort of, or recruiters have some sort of advantage because they're always conscious of keeping a decent sort of contact book. But most normal human beings don't do this. You know, they kind of go through life and people come in and out of those lives and they start wanting to run a new idea. But then suddenly they're wandering around thinking, oh, who can I do this with? You know, what's missing? And they struggle to find that. Worst thing I've ever seen, although not the worst thing, but perhaps one of the painful things that I see is when I see shout outs for a co-founder, you know, I'm looking for, you know, a business co-founder. I'm looking for a technical person to build this. And I'm thinking, you know what, good luck to you. I'm pleased that you've gone out publicly to do it, but it's going to be some hard yards, man, to try and do
it. You probably have better luck on Tinder. Yeah. Just swipe right or left. I don't know which way it is.
Well, I
just look for engineers on Tinder.
Yeah, I think so. It's really going to be tough. It's one of those things that if you have a pre-built network, as is the case at all the time, that's just going to give you this huge competitive advantage. Okay, let's talk about sort of your journey. You're from California. You're born in the US. When did you start moving out and start going to different places? Was there a reason for any of this? You've been to a few places that I would say are generally quite unusual. Can you sort of give us an idea as to when you knew that actually you wanted to explore different parts of the world and live and work in different spots?
Well, so as long as I've been working in technology, I've been working with people that were in faraway, distant places. Maybe that meant on the other side of the country, and then it expanded to the other side of the world. This is always played a role for me. That doesn't mean that I was traveling, right? But I've hired people in more than 30 countries, and worked with people, even as an employee, you know, in many countries. And I think this was this experience that I've had that kind of made me feel like, well, you know, people all over the world are part of our team. And okay, we're sitting in Palo Alto, but there are members of our team in South America, in Uruguay, in Ukraine, in Eastern Europe, and you know, here we are all working together. And I'm not, this is everything now. But this has been my experience during my whole career. Now, a lot of that has been about resource availability versus capital, right? So you've got this much capital, you need to get this much done. But I think I've always understood that wouldn't last forever. When I first landed in Ukraine 10 years ago, sure, the market was less expensive. But the opportunity in Ukraine wasn't about cost optimization. It was about resource availability, just about resource availability and the quality of the talent. So now I understood that there was so much more than what was just right in front of me in California or in the US. And I like to travel. I like to travel, just to be honest. Like, I like traveling. So, you know, exploring new places and building something along the way is, yeah, that's good stuff. I'm having fun.
What's your view on the, because it sounds like your a default position is that remote first is the way in terms of new way of building companies because of the ability to access a much wider talent pool at better cost and be more competitive that way. As you mentioned right at the beginning, Jonathan, if you're like struggling to hire your team, that's actually a big business constraint. That's actually one of the biggest reasons why your company might fail if you don't actually get the right people in working for you. It seems that you've very much committed to this idea of working remote only. What are your views on people that say, you know what, I need to get people around me in the room? You know, how do you do product when, you know, people are distributed? We have better culture, we have better innovation, we have better creativity, we want to be on premise. What's your sort of view on that and how do you see the future playing out in terms of competition? Because you're going to get some companies do one thing and other companies do another. So what's your view on the remote versus on-premise kind of argument?
I can share this from a hiring perspective because in our marketplace, we see requisitions from companies that want to hire in office or hybrid, right? Because we're global. So you may be a company that has 20 global offices, and rather than use Lundy as a solution for hiring in a country where you don't have presence, use Lundy as a single vendor, single contract, you know, single invoice solution for your 20 global offices. So we see this, and you know, I can tell you, without getting into specific customers, you know, conversion rate is very different. Hire rates are very different from, you know, the companies that are saying come into the office, or even come into the office sometimes. When we compare that, even apples for apples. So I'm not talking about, you know, with salary parity, with benefit parity, when we're really comparing the two things, people really choose the remote job, the job with flexibility. Maybe in some countries, people want to have the possibility to go to the office, right? So we see this different from country to country. But in some countries, people want to be able to go to the office. If we look at Ukraine, outside of the IT community, people are going to the office. People still go to the office. Poland also, people are going to the office outside of the IT community, right? And somebody that might be working remotely for the first time, because the whole opportunity here for companies, it's not to go to people that already have experience working remotely. That's not the opportunity for capturing talent that's on the table right now. The opportunity for, you know, tapping into those 1 billion knowledge workers that are in the world, when you're a company on the other side of the world, is being able to compete at the local level, meaning, you know, same benefits, same notice period, full-time employment in your local currency with, you know, with a local employment contract in your language. And I think for the first time, we're really seeing, you know, we've seen such an explosion of companies like this. You did the same thing we're doing right now with Tony Jamuz from Oyster. So Oyster is a great example of this, where you can come as a company and you can say, look, okay, so I'm going to hire here and here and here and here and here, and just have, you know, one solution for it. So I think that's really leveled the playing field for companies that are hiring the other side of the world like it never did before. You know, I would feel comfortable before.
Let me put this to you. I think I agree with you, and most people would agree with you as well, in the sense that you are definitely going to have a competitive advantage at the top of the funnel in terms of hiring people. So in other words, a remote-only company, you're going to get more candidates. It's going to be easier to bring those folks on board. All of that is true. But just to steel man the on-premise argument, the on-premise guys might say, yeah, we're going to take longer to hire these people. I accept that. But once we do hire them, those folks are going to be more productive. They're going to gel more with the team, and they're going to produce more creative output. So there'll be other reasons why they would then be better than remote only. They may argue, for instance, hey, what we'll achieve in on-premise is that we'll actually get better at efficiency, and we'll get better at communication because we're all in person, and we'll accelerate at that moment. So yes, it's almost like a rabbit and hare scenario. The tortoise and the hare, should I say. The hare is the remotes, they can hire quick. But the tortoise is the on-premise. They're going to beat you at the end because they're going to be more stable, and they're going to be able to be, you know, due to work, let's say creative work or collaboration work, a bit more efficiently than remote only. What's your argument to that Steelman view?
That's a tough one. I think that data tells a different story. Data tells us the story that people are just as productive, if not more. Okay, I know the counter argument to that, which is people don't have any work-life balance anymore. And that's, they're more productive because they worked 18 hours yesterday because they were just working the whole time. They never turned off. All right. Okay. But anyway, data tells a different story here, right? Data shows that people are at least as productive. Companies that have been working pretty much entirely remotely for, I mean, what are we in, going into year 3 here? The world economy didn't collapse. In fact, it did quite the opposite. I mean, in the last few days, but in any case, companies have done this in a forced way, and I think that it's accelerated for sure this change. I understand that a lot of companies are going back to work. A lot of companies, particularly if we think about outside of IT, like we have customers that are in financial, they're in financial services. You're going to the office. Sorry, that's like they were going to the office in COVID. With companies that are in customer service, this kind of stuff. Yes, okay. For data privacy and other reasons, I don't know. You should still be able to work that out without going in the office. Okay, we'll just listen to whatever they have to say. I think there are regulatory reasons for saying you have to work in an office. Or of course, like that Amazon package is not going to package itself. You're not going to work remotely packing Amazon packages. You're going to have to go to the warehouse. But I think, for knowledge work, I'm not really sure that like being together like we are right now is much different than if I could, kind of reach out and touch you a little bit.
Yeah, that would be quite alarming if we could do that, through the screen, so to speak. But who knows?
We could
maybe
try.
Maybe one of these days we'll get there. No, I think most of the things that you're saying there, the majority of people would agree with you in the sense that, yes, there seems to be some good evidence that people can get on with their jobs. That's totally fine. There's kind of lived evidence that we've all lived the experience of this, and it seems okay. But I'm interested to know, there's certain companies that are, very convinced that they need to be in person. I wonder whether it's got to do with the nature of the job in a certain way. I think sometimes it might be. Certain jobs, for instance, may require the sort of intensive collaboration that's different from a more task-based job, for instance, which is more easily outsourceable. I think we can understand that aspect. And also regulatory reasons, as you mentioned, there's legal reasons and compliance issues, which means that you might need to be physically on there. You can't take the stuff home because there's a risk there. And I think there's also some legacy issues. You mentioned finance guys, for instance, and all those types of professions. There's a lot of legacy in terms of culture that forces people to be back in, so to speak. I think that's potentially a ripe for disruption also, because there'll be a competitor emerging from disaffected workers that refuse to go back to on-premise. They're going to say, see ya, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm going to set up my own consultancy or my own finance business or my own thing. And we're going to compete with you from remote only. And we'll let the market decide who wins on that. Because you can imagine that a remote only business would certainly be more cost competitive than an on-premise business. And it will also be faster to grow because of the access to talent and the conversion of talent will be higher. Again, lots of reasons why we might think that is the case. I had an idea, actually. One of the reasons why it's easier to potentially hire remote workers is simply that you're asking less of the candidate. The candidate is sitting where they're sitting. For them to get a remote job, to switch to another remote job, probably isn't going to be a huge lifestyle upheaval than it would be if I had to go on premise. If I was to take a job tomorrow, which told me I needed to go to an office, even though if that office is 20-minute cycle ride away, it would still be a significant thing I've got to think about before I commit to the concept of doing that. Whereas if it was just another remote job, it's like, hey, I'm still sitting exactly where I'm sitting and I could still do that job and test it for the work that it is, rather than have this lifestyle upheaval that on-premise requires. So I think you're right in terms of the competitiveness to hire is going to be difficult for those on-premise folks to challenge and work with. Jonathan, you mentioned something interesting about your product. In the sense, it's the international sort of a dimension of it. And it's you mentioned that there seems to be some regional variance as to what the attitude to remote working is. I think that's plausible. That may well be true based on how different regions have dealt with pandemic, also based on distribution of the types of work that people do, and also the types of living standards they have at home. If you're living, for instance, in East Asia, for instance, very small homes, typically very densely packed sort of places, it might actually be very difficult to work from home comfortably because you don't have a huge space where you've got all the facilities.
This is exactly correct. I think a lot of people don't realize that. Yeah, I think a lot of people aren't thinking, oh, well, why don't you work from home? They're not necessarily thinking about where, where the talent is, where their employee is, that they might not have an office nook or a spare bedroom converted into their home office. That's like a that's a really first world opinion of how somebody may be able to work remotely. Or they may have a place like that, but they may have children at home that are, out of school because of because of whatever reason, right? So it's a little bit less true now, but I think that it's presumptive to imagine that somebody has a workspace in their residence that they'll be able to be productive in.
It's the control aspect, I think. The ability to control your environment is so important, because if you've got busy stuff to do and there's other things around you physically that you can't control, but are also super important, then these things are going to have an impact. I mean, especially if you've got young children, those kids need attention. And even if it's not like 24 by 7 focused attention, if
It's
it is
pretty
intermittent,
non-attention.
yeah,
It's
but it's
pretty
intermittent.
nonstop.
It's intermittent, isn't it? It's intermittent, and it's always you always got to be there. It's a small thing typically, but you've got to just be on it. And that diversion, I think, is going to interrupt your ability to do work. Again, anecdotally only, but I've got loads of friends that are parents to young children, and I seem to see sort of a bit of a division between how positive they are to the concept of potentially doing some time in the office. Versus people that don't have kids, basically, who are, I think, much more pro not ever going back in ever again. So again, life circumstances, home circumstances make a big difference. Okay, so let's have a look at sort of the product a little bit more, Jonathan. Tell us where we're at with Lundi. So it's an operating business, operating marketplace. There's like dozens of countries in there. How long have you been going? Like, can you give us some numbers? Like, how long have you been going? Where do you operate? How many recruiters are kind of onboarded? Because I think that's the challenge of marketplace, isn't it? You've got to also get the supply as well. So give us some numbers on all of that stuff, Jonathan.
So we started just at the beginning of 2020. So
Super young. Yeah.
we're exactly, spot on, born in the pandemic. And so a couple of years in, we have more than 3,000 recruiters and agencies that are on our platform today. We're in 66 countries, maybe 67 now. 66 is usually the number, but I think maybe 67. Anyway, more than 65, simple enough, and covering 40 languages. And so if we're, not in the country where the talent is, we definitely have somebody almost surely that speaks the language and can do it from somewhere nearby. So that's kind of the state of the business today. We are working with a pretty wide range of customers from, public traded, massive, very big companies, some of the largest HR services companies in the world, giant international software consultancies, but big companies. And on the other side of that, kind of mid-market startups, so later stage like Series B and beyond, in the range of scale-ups, so that kind of have some budget for this, because a lot of times, when you're really early, well, you should do this yourself, actually, right? You shouldn't take the $1 million in capital that you've just received and give it us. That's not what we want, right? So, at the stage where you have a budget for a third-party search, then that's usually a good stage for us to be able to work together. And most companies that are before that, they don't have a lot of work to do. So, for companies like that, we've got companies that were, backed by Y Combinator as customers, for example, Bain Capital, Emergence, things like this, right? So, yeah, that's what it looks like.
What's the, I mean, as a marketplace, one of the key challenges is liquidity, right? Like, how do you, because you got to get the buyers, you got to get the suppliers, you got to get the candidates as well. How did you tackle this problem? Did you like go with one side for, I mean, I know everyone says, hey, you got to do everything at the same time, and I totally get it. That's exactly what you do have to do. But did you lean into, oh, we need to acquire the jobs first, or did you lean into, look, we have to get the supply first, we have to get the, we have to get like at least 100 agencies on platform? How did you kind of tackle that sort of the first challenge, I guess?
So we had a little bit of an unfair advantage, but I will agree with the statement that in a marketplace, you need to choose one side to build first. And that's a chicken or egg problem, because if you have employers and no recruiters, then that's just totally a bomb, right? Nobody will receive any talent and they will not be happy. And if you have recruiters,
if you give them that experience, they'll never come back. If they post a job, there's nothing coming back at them. It's like they're out. And that's a tough lesson to learn. You have to give them something, or at least be confident there's something coming back at them if they're going to make some sort of commitment that way. So, yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
So, you know, the other side of that is really the sell side on our platform. And you know, those are local talent experts, recruiters, and agencies all over the world. You know, they were a little bit more open to this idea of, hey, this is what we're going to do. It might take you a few months before we give you something that you say, maybe I'm interested, maybe I'm not interested. But anyway, it costs you nothing. It takes you 5 minutes to fill out a form on a website. We're going to look at your LinkedIn profile. Somebody will reach out. You know, if it looks like there's not a fit here, otherwise we'll get you approved. And you know, and you'll start to receive matches in a few months. And that's actually kind of, that's the route that we took, right? So we went out to recruiters, to talent experts in communities where we had identified that there's like a higher availability of knowledge workers, right? So we're not exclusively a tech recruitment platform. And so we've looked at parts of the world, you know, using our technology, where we identified, okay, here are hotspots for talent. Now let's go into those markets and let's resource. Let's resource in those markets. Yeah, okay, we don't have recs today. But anyway, we know what will happen if you, and we don't have recruiters on the other side. That'll be a bigger problem.
Yeah,
so that was what we did.
I totally agree. I think basically acquiring the suppliers, and you can, to a certain degree, you can just sort of have them sit there for a period, but because you can then activate them per job, right? I mean, you could basically collect the job, and you can identify, oh, you know, these 7 recruiters in this location are suitable for this. But rather than just leave it passively to the platform, you can just reach out to those people as well and say, hey, listen, this has happened. It's the first one in. Do you want to give this a shot? No pressure either way. It's there. It's basically a free lead for them. And they can go ahead and do that. So there's ways in which you can kind of white glove it in the background, so to speak. You know, and no automated system works without some sort of like massaging with the, you know, some human being.
Sure.
Like, I call it white gloving it, right? It's like some guy at the back is basically making this happen. And even though you might not show that in the front of house, you can do this in the background, hopefully with not too much effort, and get those people activated to work on those platforms. Work on those jobs. Okay, cool. Tell us what's happening down the pipe for 2022 for customers of Lundy already. If they're working, sort of they're already posting jobs on the platform, and they're getting throughput and so forth. I guess that's the main thing. That's the main thing that they're looking for. But is there anything else that you can tell those folks? You know, what can they expect in terms of product build or market development? Like, what are the plans for the rest of 22 for you?
So one thing that we think is a gap now in the market, and that I'll share openly, is that there are companies like Oyster, for example, that give you a platform to hire all over the world. And there are companies like Lundy, or maybe just a company like Lundy. Okay, there should be more, or we don't have a business. So I hope I have competitors. I'm sure I do. I even know them. And we're a platform for sourcing talent globally. But neither of the two are very connected. Now, of course, Oyster's our partner. You couldn't have guessed by that I've said it 3 times. But in any case, what we're really excited about is how we can connect those 2 things together. So if you're a company and you want to hire talent internationally, that, you know, the answer isn't, okay, go pay 22% to a recruiter over Lundy and then take the next step to hire that candidate through a, you know, through an EOR platform. And what we're really excited about is the opportunity to connect those two things together.
Right.
How, you know, it's a little bit, I mean, it's a little bit like staff leasing deconstructed, actually, to be fair. Right. But how we can connect those things together to give access to more companies. All right, that if you want to hire somebody, they're not just like, oh, I have to pay a placement fee and then I got to go through this employment process, that I could kind of get it done in one stroke.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think recruiters generally want turnkey solutions. And to be honest with you, they often get outraged that you don't provide a turnkey because they're so busy with other things that, you know, anything that doesn't give them, like, as you say, a one-shot solution all the way through, it's just additional admin work to do. And these folks who work in recruiting, I used to work in recruiting, you know, you don't have a spare time. If you have any sort of minutes in the day, you're doing extra stuff to mitigate risk. So absolutely, I think the ability to hire through one platform and just close it all the way through, that would be perfect. So great that you've connected up with Oyster, big friends of ours. Obviously, they've been a huge sponsor of Brain Food, everything, to be honest, this year. So I've heard a lot about those, more so than their immediate competitors, even though I know that's like a kind of a Godzilla versus King Kong plus Mothra kind of dogfight there with these three. I think there's three like huge companies like fighting for the universe there. But let's see who wins out on that score. Okay, tell us a little bit about sort of recruitment agencies. What's your view as to what's going to happen to the agency market itself? Do you see agencies, for instance, being able to increase their fees? Do they have to get used to getting lower fees? Are they going to be more fragmented, in other words, more solo players? Or are they going to end up aggregating towards, you know, back into big companies? Do you have any kind of perspective on where your general kind of intuition is for the recruitment agency market?
So we love agencies and we need agencies. As Lundy, right? But one of the challenges, I think, from a buyer's perspective, as an employer in this new world that we're living in, if I'm not sure where I want to hire, maybe I'm going to look at three countries. So I've gone to Lundy, or I've done research myself. I've gone on LinkedIn Talent Insights, because apparently my company has a lot of money for that. And I've found the answer. Well, here are the places where talent is available. And I've picked 3 to 5 markets. And then I go to agencies in those markets. I'm going to hear things like exclusivity. I'm going to hear things, words like retainer, which, look, we're all running businesses here. So I'm not like saying, retainers are bad. Please, please, please. If you can get it, take it. But
it's scary for the buyer. It's scary for the buyer.
Yeah, if I'm an employer, I don't know that I'm actually going to hire somebody in Romania. I just, like, you know, some researcher on my team, or a partner company, or some software that I used told me, oh, you can probably find that person in, you know, Greece or Romania, Ukraine, or India. And now I'm going to call up agencies, assuming that I knew some, for one role, and try to find, and then pay. Something about that model doesn't work, right?
Yeah, and to be honest with you, the discovery of the suppliers is going to be the second problem. I mean, we see this in the Brain Food community all the time. I'm actually surprised. You should get one of your guys onto the group there, because oftentimes you get people say, hey, we've just decided to set up a remote hub in this place. Does anybody know a local supplier? Can anybody help? And then inevitably someone says, yeah, this company does this. But the idea that they have to go around and have that conversation in the first place tells me there's a huge information problem there. because they obviously can't Google it. We're at the point already where we understand the search engine doesn't actually do what we want the search engines to do. Google is not going to deliver you this information. It's impossible to find this thing. If you typed in, I want a recruitment agency in X country, it's going to produce you a load of ads from probably global companies.
What it's going to look like is globalization partners, omnipresence. Oyster is not such an offender on this one, but you know, you're typing like recruit remote internationally, something like this, and then what you get back are EORs that don't do recruitment.
Yeah, we're not going to get, we basically have no way to retrieve this information. So they're going literally having conversations with their friends. It's no different from going to a bar and trying to, you know, have a chat publicly and say, hey, does anyone know this? Obviously inefficient. So there's obviously an information gap that Lundy could even provide. And as you say, is a talent insights feature in your service. It'd be great if that was like available. I mean, is it available for free? Can people use it, or do you need to be a paying customer to actually get access to some of this intelligence?
So today, you do need to be a paying customer to get access. Well, okay. I mean, you know, we're a contingent platform. You need to be a contracted customer to have that kind of access. And you know, we really want to democratize that information, and it's something that we're thinking about, like from a product perspective, you know, how we may be able to open that up.
I'm gonna basically represent the market overall here, Jonathan. And as I've got the CEO of the business sitting right in front of me, I'm gonna say it would be a great lead generator if you were able to say, I'm gonna give you like three searches. You don't have to give like every search out there. Just say, I'm gonna give you three searches, and you could do some talent insight stuff. As you say, you can do this on LinkedIn and cost yourself a fortune. Or you can try this for free. And I think what will happen is a bunch of people will try it, and they'll eventually, once they've discovered what they want or validate what they want, they're going to start looking at all of those other things you'll offer, like, oh, and here's some suppliers that can deal it, can sort it for you. That, I think, would be a winning ticket if it's something that you can switch on.
I mean, I think that's the talent insights challenge, though, also, if you think about the data that's on LinkedIn. So, you know, market penetration for LinkedIn is great in Western countries.
Correct. It's definitely not so good in, it's very clear, by the way, very clear where it is. Yeah.
Not so good for most of the countries where there's an opportunity for hiring knowledge workers. So the data is not even out there, even through the sources where you can buy today. Because we tried to buy it in the beginning rather than build it, right? Well, let's just go buy all this data and we'll roll it into our own product. And you know, in the end, we had to build it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we all lived in a LinkedIn universe. There's no doubt about that. But it's a small universe. It's English language, firstly. There's multiple countries that don't use it and that can't use it. There's whole swaths of like continents, like Africa, LATAM even, is not
just heavy not there users. Really.
Yeah, they're not using this. So they're using something else, and we don't know about that. So if you're truly going for a globalized, as you say, if you're seeking opportunity where the talent really is, the untapped opportunity, then you can't really lean on something that is basically heavily mined and focused towards, you know, as you say, the global north or the first world or however which way you want to call it. So Jonathan, in terms of your let's say you're coming across a young kid that wants to do entrepreneurship. They want to kind of, you know, they're listening to the show and they're thinking, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to do this. What kind of advice would you give this young person? Things that you've kind of learned maybe through the hard way to say, look, here's the for real journey, you know, about what it is to be an entrepreneur. And here are a few things that if you did, it'll save you some time and it'll save you some heartache. Can you give that young person some advice, Jonathan?
Sure. So it's a lot harder and more painful than it looks. Not so glamorous, but the other end of that, right, the success, when you have it, and you won't have it every time, you'll fail more than you will succeed, is really rewarding. This is the drug that you're after, right? It's not only the, it's not even or not only like a money focus, right? Because I mean, that's numbers on the internet and it comes and it goes and it's up and it's down and it's left and it's right. And that fame, that bump from having any kind of success doesn't even last for 15 minutes. It lasts for 15 internet minutes, which is like 15 seconds and nobody cares. And I think that the most important thing to do as a founder, as a young entrepreneur, it's to work on something that you care about, something that even when you feel like everything is falling apart, even when you feel like everything is wrong, that you'll be like, yeah, but I still want to do this. I mean, you have to live in reality a little bit. There is a time to stop. But you will face challenge after challenge, and how you face up to those challenges will define who you are as a leader and as an entrepreneur. So surround yourself with people that are smarter than you every day, all the time. Don't be the smartest person in the room, even if you think you are. It's okay to think you are, but anyway, still find smarter people. And be ready for failure, and be ready to change rapidly, and be ready to be wrong. Wow, relatively.
No, I totally get it. This is really sound advice. I think the failure has almost become a fetish these days. I'm glad on one side that we're starting to talk about it, which is great. But on the other side, it's like, you know, we don't want to make sure we revel in it per se, but it's really important to understand what failure means, in the sense that it's a significant setback. But it's not like necessarily destructive to who you are, or what it is you want to do. And the sooner you understand that, the suddenly you almost get like instant resilience. It's almost like, you know, a packet of instant noodles. You become like immediately more resilient once you realize, oh, it's not killed me. I do think it's maybe similar to riding a bike or something. You fall off a couple of times. Yeah, it's not great, but you come back on the bike and you think, yeah, I can achieve, this is all okay. And you recognize that it's okay, but you do need to fall off a few times. I wonder whether actually, just as an aside, it might actually be like a smart move to try and engineer some failure in people's journeys a little bit, you know, in a safe way. You know, I don't know, I'm not a parent, maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm just thinking, hey, if you could set your child up to kind of fail in this controlled way, in a safe way that isn't like emotionally destructive, it might actually be really good educationally, because that kid will then understand, you know what, that wasn't so bad. It was a tough hit, but I'm still here and I'm going to still go forward. And that, I think, is one of the key sort of factors for any type of success. And like I say, recruiting Brain Food is by no means a startup in any sense. It's just a newsletter really and a podcast, but it did have its fail points. It did have multiple points where I thought, what am I doing? This is pointless. But because I enjoyed it, because I'd failed so many times before, it didn't occur to me that it was the obvious thing to, I wasn't crushed by those setbacks, because there was other setbacks I've had, which were even worse, and, you know, they didn't crush me either. So, generally speaking, nothing is that devastating. Anyway, Jonathan, we're coming to the end of the hour we have, so I don't want to keep you any longer than you need to be. What kind of things, what kind of CEO things are you doing for the rest of the day? What's happening for you and Lundy for the rest of today, Jonathan?
So we're talking to many new companies. In fact, my last call finishes at 11 p.m. tonight. So,
oh no!
It's my fault that I'm 11 hours ahead of San Francisco, right? I made that choice, so I can suffer the consequences, but you know, remain calm. It's not every day until 11 o'clock, but today it is. Today it is.
No worries. And customers is always, customer acquisition at sort of that early stage is always a thrilling thing. I remember running a tech startup as well, having any customer, no matter what the value size, no matter what the ticket value, it's like, yes, there's people in here that believe in this service. It gives you validation, gives the team a boost, and it's great things. Okay, Jonathan, listen, let's leave it here. Thank you so much for your time. For the folks who are listening to this and are interested in finding more about Lundy, where do they go and find that? What's the website that they should check out?
Yeah, hello Lundy, LUNDI.com.
HelloLundy.com. So if you are basically looking to internationalize your recruiting or access the global talent pool, and you have some sort of jobs that you want to put onto this platform, go and check this out, because it may be another way in which we could, this may be another way in which you could help fill that talent shortage. Okay, Jonathan, let me let you go for your busy day. Great to see you, sir. Thank you for coming on to Founders Focus.
Thanks, Hung. Take care.
Cool. Wasn't that great, guys? He's a very animated fellow, Jonathan. I do like him. Hopefully one day we'll get the chance to meet up in person. Okay, that's about it, everyone, for Founders Focus. We're going to be doing this more or less every week on Wednesday. So we've kind of settled on Wednesday as the date when we're going to be doing these types of shows. So do expect next week. I believe it's episode 17, and I believe it is my good friend, Nico Blier-Silvest, CEO of Platypus. They are a culture matching, a culture ad type of platform, a really innovative, I think perfectly suited to the remote world that we're in. You know, how do you know this person is going to be a real cultural ad to your team? You don't until you maybe check it out using a tool like Platypus. So make sure you join us for that. Follow the channel if you want to hear more. We're back also on Brainfood Live on Friday. We're talking about, does TA and HR have institutional lack of confidence? How do we improve this? We've got some wonderful guests coming to join us for that conversation. To see, you know, how we can reposition TA and HR to the point where, you know, we are an influencer and not being influenced. Okay, that's about it. Have a good midweek, everybody. Thanks for watching.